The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org. Voice of San Diego podcasts are sponsored by the Bob Nelson Charitable Fund, honoring the San Diego Harbor Police Foundation.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 Cogo. My name is Scott Lewis. I'm the CEO. Editor-Chief at Voice of San Diego. I'm joined, as always, by Assistant Editor Andrew Keats.
What's up?
Hello.
Hello.
Sarah Libby, Managing Editor. Hello.
Hello.
And just a quick shout-out. I got a compliment this week on how well this show has sounded over the last few months of remote work, and that is all due to our producer, who's also here as a kind of ghost. His name is Nate John. Nate John, and we're always happy to have him. He's a master at what he does, so thank you, Nate. Coming up on the show today, we're going to look back on the week in response to the coronavirus. The County Board of Supervisors wields a lot of power and a lot of money, and a lot more people know what they do. We're going to talk about what they've been up to this week. One of the things they talked about was schools, and schools, as always, are causing a lot of confusion right now. San Diego Unified does have a balanced budget, but only because of COVID relief support from the federal government and other places. Plus, the teachers union has some new demands about reopening. And finally, we need to talk about land. Mayor Kevin Faulkner wants to overhaul how the city permits housing before he leaves office, plus how all of that relates to why some parts of the city of San Diego have lousy parks and others definitely do not. That's all coming up. Let's first start, though, with the county supervisors. They weighed into the school's dilemma I've been obsessing about for the first time. So this week they had $48 million they were trying to decide what to do with from the Federal CARES Act. You guys remember the CARES Act? Still dealing with lots of cash from that. And they decided they wanted to put about $25 million to child care, which is a big step there. About $18, $19 million to food assistance. Diane Jacob, the county supervisor, decided she wants a lot of that to go to restaurants, so kind of combine the restaurant support with getting food to people who need it. Jim Desmond's like, well, why don't we just give it to the food bank? It was a really interesting conversation. But then this discussion came up about testing at schools. And just to drive you back, we've talked on this show with Dr. Rebecca Fielding Miller, an epidemiologist. She said recently on Twitter, I cannot, quote, think of anything that should be a higher priority than ensuring robust, frequent, and culturally competent testing for childcare and schools. And the county there was discussing about a $5 million investment in testing at schools, but not everyone was on board. Here is Supervisor Kristen Gaspar. Represents the sort of north coastal area, Encinitas, those kinds of places. She is not into that idea.
I actually have a disagreement with the $5 million going to the testing within the schools. As a mother of three, I prefer to keep my child's medical care between my trusted pediatric team. And if we're trying to come up with a way to test our kids at school, that's something as a parent I'd be extremely uncomfortable with. So I do not support $5 million in testing going to our K through 12 schools as a mom.
I didn't expect that. I thought it was kind of universal that, you know, more testing helps us get out. You know, as Rebecca Fielding Miller talks about it, you know, your status was a big part of people worried about HIV and AIDS, getting about their lives again. She's heading towards a theory that maybe no more collective action should be taken on the virus in a way.
I mean, what she said is precisely a word-for-word thing that people say to oppose vaccine requirements in public schools as well.
Yeah. is that.
Yeah, the degree to which like anti-vaccination stuff has crept into this entire conversation and almost come to dominate like one side of it is pretty fascinating. I never underestimate the ability of anti-vaccination activists to dwarf a conversation.
Yeah, well, and in this case, you know, so in previously, anti-vaccination groups had used some of their existing audience to help spread word about protests to open up the county, and they did this all around the country. But in this case, I actually think it's a little bit more more troubling in that she's just adopting the language and logic of anti-vaccination positions and now applying it to this virus that's disrupted life and using that logic as a barrier to get back to something resembling normalcy.
Well, let's draw that through line. I mean, what they always say is like, we don't want to get into a situation. They're always opposing this idea that you have to be somehow medically cleared to go to school, and what she's drawing that line out to this cause. But I think what else she missed in there is this question of, you know, parent or adults. So a lot of, you know, there's a lot of evidence, of course, that kids aren't necessarily suffering or spreading this virus very much. But the counterpoint to that always is, well, what about all the teachers, counselors, custodial people, everybody who works with kids who may have underlying conditions or just, you know, be simply more vulnerable to the virus? And, you know, if I was going to just take $5 million, which is a drop, there's no way $5 million makes a big difference in testing in the region for schools. But if I had that much, I would take it and test adults, educators. I would make that, they're the workers we're paying to be in there. They're the most vulnerable. That would be the first step. And she didn't touch that.
Well, I mean, their parents would also need to have a say in the matter.
That's a good one, Andy. All right. Like I said, I think that Kristen Gaspar seems to be heading toward a theory that no more collective action should be taken on stopping the virus. She put out a statement last week saying, you know, we can't keep toggling on and off our economy. It didn't quite say like we should just live with it, but it kind of did. Her statement said like, you know, we just have to live with the virus and with the economy. And, you know, what she then did and proposed was that the county hire a statistician to look at the numbers that the county's put out and kind of prove that it's not a big deal. That's the best summary I can do of what her proposal was. They adopted it 4-1. Nathan Fletcher said no. Here was her comments about why we shouldn't necessarily worry about how many young people are getting, or younger people under 40 are getting the virus.
But again, it's about not overwhelming the hospital system. So if we have younger people who have, that are asymptomatic, that have mild to moderate cases, we've heard a lot about herd immunity. You know, when this younger population that has a wonderful chance at recovery from all of this contracts with a very mild to moderate case or no symptoms at all, that's a wonderful step toward creating that herd immunity that our public health officer has spoken about before as being important. These are unlikely to be hospitalized cases. These are unlikely to be ICU cases. These are unlikely to be cases that overwhelm our hospital system, which is actually a really positive thing.
I think the unlikely is what's doing some work there, because if the spike in cases doesn't turn into hospitalizations, that'd be great. But we're kind of waiting to see. The hospitalizations did shoot up last week. They've plateaued a little bit, but now they're going back up. That's the number I keep watching.
It's also, I guess, just dependent on what you consider mild to moderate. And like we've talked a lot about this before, is that not dying isn't the only like gauge of how this virus is acting. And so, you know, we know so little about it still that the long-term impacts of somebody who has even a seemingly mild case could be in fact pretty traumatic or severe, and we just don't know. And so it seems like something you would still want to try and not get if you could.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I had a friend, he's about exactly my age, kids are my age. I talked last week about him. He went in the hospital 10 days. He just got out, I think, today. You know, that's a pretty significant impact on his life, on the costs of the healthcare system, and on just, you know, his recovery. It's not something he's going to get over for a while. It feels a little awkward to say this is a positive thing.
Yeah, it's a little strange. I'm not exactly sure that what we're missing here is a statistician. There are examples all around the country that we can look to. It is the case that so far we have not tested our hospital capacity. But you can look in Arizona and Florida and Texas right now, and the increase in cases has led to all the downstream increases that we would have expected. And I guess I just don't understand why we would think that we're special in some way, why the virus would behave differently here than it has elsewhere. It's been in some ways quite predictable, actually.
Well, that's the debate shaping up at the County of San Diego. Again, they used some of that money for food assistance and childcare, and now they've gotten a foot in the door on testing for schools. As I said, with schools, I think testing should be a major part of it. I think they should spread out as best they can, including the outdoors, and then build the best possible, or partner with the best possible homeschool platform for people that don't want to go in there. We're getting more and more updates from local schools about what they're going to do. High Tech High this week, a chain of charter schools, announced that they're either A, going to do fully remote online classes, or B, they're going to do a hybrid system, or C, they're going to do all on campus, but only for third grade and below. And so underneath that is the assumption that if you're above third grade in the High Tech High system, you are not going back to school full time at the physical locations. We're hearing from Catholic schools and other private schools that are doing some kind of hybrid model, some that just still have not committed. Carlsbad this week put out an email saying they're not committed to what they're going to do. They're going to figure, they have all these options. They listed like 12 different options. It has just completely befuddled them. And this is my favorite update, was Poway Unified School District. They're facing a petition. They wrote off the hybrid model of the couple days a week, or a week on, week off kind of thing. They wrote that off, said it's not feasible. They're getting a petition now from teachers and parents saying, no, you got to put that back. They responded and said, they responded to that and other concerns. And the one part that really stuck out to me, which I think highlights just how hard this is for these districts, is their discussion about masks. They said, as it relates to the wearing of masks by students, there's some confusion that PUSD has made a final decision that is either anti-mask or pro-mask. We are neither. So,
oof. Yeah, I don't blame them either. I don't blame them either, but it's always amazing to me when people or entities think that not making a decision isn't itself a decision.
Right. Yeah, and that's a perfect example. Like, the mask, the argument of the pro-mask sect is that everyone needs to wear masks.
Right.
And so to be neither means you are anti-mask. Neither is not an option. It's either everyone needs to wear masks, or you don't agree that everyone needs to wear masks. So the internal logic of their statement doesn't even hold up.
Well, it shows just how terrified they are of these very basic questions. Like, are you going to require masks? You know, it's like, it's not, that's like, one of the...
Well, our answer is we're not going to answer that question, and shame on you for thinking that that carries any sort of implication.
And this came up this week. So President Trump, in his eloquence, said basically, open schools. You got to open the schools.
That was good.
And then I love his governing style.
Could have come like straight from Scott Lewis's Twitter account.
It's just like my son, where it's like, I'm hungry. Okay. Let's talk about that. So then everyone pointed out that it was his government that made it so confusing. It was the CDC's guidelines that everybody's like, I don't know how to handle those guidelines. So he comes back and he says, yeah, those are bad too. It's like, oh man, thanks, buddy. And then so they asked the CDC. There was an amazing interview with the CDC head Redfield and George Stephanopoulos from ABC, and they're like, so are you going to change your guidance after the president said you should? And he's like, well, our guidance is just options. It's just a portfolio of things.
George, we are never neither pro nor anti our own guidance.
Yeah. And so I find this fascinating that conservatives and Trump have decided to jump on the open normal schools side of things as opposed to embracing the like homeschool potential disruption that's literally on. And then you have on the other side, I was waiting to see what the teachers union are doing, and they seem to have gone to embracing homeschool. So we have this, my mind is just breaking, where we have teachers unions championing homeschool and remote options and conservatives saying normal schools are the way, the public schools are the way. The remarkable time we're in continues to change our priors, I guess. All right, Andy had a story this week that I thought was pretty good. As his time in office is coming to an end, San Diego Mayor Kevin Faulkner is trying to overhaul how the city makes land use decisions. Andy, this is called the Complete Communities Plan, and if you're in some neighborhoods in the city, you've probably seen weird flyers about it on social media or next door. All kinds of people freaking out that you know, big apartment complexes right next to their homes are going to be built. Let's explain this as best we can. What is the mayor's plan to overhaul how these kinds of decisions are made, especially for housing projects?
Yeah, so let's start with housing, because it has a bunch of different components. The housing proposal is an optional program. Developers would be allowed to take advantage of it if it passes city council. It would only apply to properties that are already zoned to allow for townhouses or apartments, and the properties would need to be within a half a mile of a trolley station or high-frequency bus lines. And if they did, then depending on where they are in the city, how close to downtown they are in the city, they would essentially get a new set of development restrictions apart from the ones that are in place based on community plans. So the density restrictions imposed by community plans or the height restrictions imposed by community plans or some other citywide measure would not apply to them. That is not true, however, in the coastal zone. In the coastal zone, the 30-foot height limit would supersede this proposal no matter what. That is basically the long and the short of it. The idea being developers would get all these extra benefits to build more houses, but then they would have to pay back in the form of low-income units as parts of their projects and more fees paid to community amenities like plazas or small parks, that sort of thing.
And this is that concept you talk about a lot, where if you let somebody build more, then they're going to make more money, so that the community has an interest in grabbing some of that for benefits.
Yeah, the wonky term for it is value capture. This is the relatively convoluted way that the mayor's office and the planning department have tried to thread a needle between getting a lot more housing built while not seeming like they were just giving developers windfall profits.
And this is like the sausage making that's coming after his big State of the City speech a year ago, where he sort of declared, I'm a YIMBY, let's build. And now we're seeing, sort of more than a year later, what that actually looks like in practice.
Yeah, this is the implementation of that promise. And so what I don't know right now, what is really hard for me to try to glean from what's available publicly, is how they could sort of horse trade to get this thing passed through the city council. It needs to get 5 votes. How are they going to do the horse trading when it's kind of getting hit from every side right now? You've got large institutional developers saying that the requirements are too onerous and that they just won't take advantage of it because they would have to give too much back. So they would just ignore it and follow the regular zoning. There are small developers who say it's really cool. Unions have said that they believe that there should be sort of union wage requirements attached to this project in some way. It's not exactly clear how that would happen. Community groups don't like the way that it is. They don't like the proposal in general. They've voted to oppose it. They also don't like the procedure it's gone through. So there's sort of something on all ends for somebody to oppose, and how that translates into votes on the city council is anyone's guess, or how the planning department reacts to all those different and completely conflicting requests to get to those votes is not something I could forecast right now.
So one key thing you mentioned there was it would only apply to areas that are zoned already for multifamily units. Right. And so single family, for better or worse, single family home zones are not part of this.
That is correct. Single family zoned homes are not a part of this. So vast swaths of the city, you know, like more than half of the city that's zoned for single family homes, there would be no change in those areas at all.
Obviously, that's meant to appease people who would freak out about that. But I have a question whether they would even understand that if they were predisposed to freak out about it. Like, is that coming across?
Well, yeah. And also, you know, like they're not necessarily only opposed to this sort of development in the literal neighboring lot. They're opposed to it in their community as a whole. So they may live in a single family zoned area, but, you know, relatively near them, perhaps there is a multifamily area and they don't want to see bigger development there either.
Now, the next part of this is really interesting. There's another part of permitting that really has a constraining effect on housing development, and that is some of the impacts they have to mitigate for regarding traffic. So if you build a project, a home, a housing project in an area, you have to see how much traffic that will generate for congestion in the area, and you have to mitigate for that. And this change would be a wholesale revision of how that is mitigated, right?
Yeah, and the city does not actually have much in the way of discretion on this. This was a state law change years ago that said you're no longer going to analyze new projects based on how much congestion they create in the streets around them. Now we need to measure instead based on how many miles of driving the projects are likely to create. The idea being that this would be a way to ensure more environmentally friendly projects. So projects that, because of where they are or how they're built or what's near them, are more likely to create people who walk to work or bike to work or take transit to the grocery store and therefore don't drive, those things would all be given a benefit. And the city, as of July 1, so it's already past the deadline here, had to create a way to do that analysis differently. And this is the way they've decided to do it. And they basically created concentric circles moving out from downtown that are deemed to be, progressively less progressively more intensive on how many miles of car driving they create. And the ones on the farthest out area, and this is the most controversial aspect of this, the ones on the farthest out area in the true suburbs would simply have to pay a fee to compensate for how much new driving they're creating. And those fees would be used for bike-friendly or pedestrian-friendly or transit-friendly projects closer into the downtown area. So it really is a wealth transfer.
So that's probably why some of those bigger developers in the outer parts of the city are opposed to it.
That's what they don't like about that component of it. Mark Kersey, who represents a lot of those areas, did not like it at all, and you know, didn't really seem especially amenable to coming around to it without significant changes. And so once again, that's another thing that I don't know how they figure out how to appease five people on that one. But, you know, which is not to say that they can't do it. I'm sure they have a strategy here, but I just don't exactly know what it is.
We did another investigation this week, this one led by Mackenzie Elmer. She did an analysis of why some parks in some parts of the city are lousy. And in many cases, that's because of how fees not unlike this work. So a development impact fee is a fee that a developer has to pay when they put housing units up. But that sort of construction has been happening a lot more in some parts of the city than it has been happening in other parts of the city, which means there's been millions for parks in places like Carmel Valley and other places like that, and not for like Sherman Heights. And so she did a really good job, I think, of really painting that disparity and explaining it. How does that relate? Will this be something they consider revising as well?
Yeah, this is part of Complete Communities. They're not even conceptually similar. They are part of the same process here. And so this other part of the Complete Communities plan would be a revision of how they fund parks based on these fees. They would change it so that fees are assessed by the square foot as opposed to by the apartment or townhouse or home. That is theoretically going to incentivize people to build more smaller units as opposed to right now. As you would imagine, the incentives are if you're going to pay the same fee for a 5,000 square foot house as you are for a 200 square foot apartment, maybe you'll just go ahead and build the house as opposed to the apartment. So this is kind of hoping to address that imbalance. But it also, right now, there's 50 separate buckets. The funds go into a different little pot for each community plan area. So all new development in Ocean Beach is charged a fee. That money goes into a bucket, and that bucket only goes to projects in Ocean Beach. And same for Carmel Valley and Golden Hill and Tierra Santa. What this would do is put all of that money into a citywide pot and say that 50% of all that money needs to go into low-income areas, and the city has created a methodology of defining what those are and who deserves them. And so they hope, or they intend, for this to be a way to fix that historic inequity in how park space is funded at the city level through new development.
But it's sort of that same controversy, right, where when you start to spread money throughout the city to different neighborhoods, people start to get upset by that.
Yeah, you could totally imagine somebody who already was inclined to oppose a project is now saying, well, at the very least before I saw this money was going to go towards building a new swing set in my local community. But now it's going to somebody else's community, so I'm even more inclined to oppose it.
That was always a frustrating thing for me, because they constantly, developers or other people who wanted more housing would always make the point like, oh, we can win over neighbors when we point out that if we allow this development, it's going to fund the infrastructure in these areas. And they would like, that would make it easier for them to accept this construction. And I never saw it once work. I never saw that promise ever win people over. And so I agree that, yeah, it would make it harder to win them over now if that money is taken out. And it also reminds me of that race, David Alvarez versus Kevin Faulkner back when. Remember, a big part of it was this sort of demonized imagery of David Alvarez taking money that was meant for your neighborhood stuff and moving it to other parts of the community. And it seems like that's now something that the mayor himself, who ran against David Alvarez with that sort of messaging, is doing.
Yeah, that's well said. And I should also say that one of the biggest problems with these 50 pots of money is it often, especially in communities that don't have that much development, it takes a long time for those pots to build up enough money in them that you can actually build a new project. And so the end result is millions of dollars across the city just sitting unused, waiting for a day in the future where it will reach a level that they could build one thing with it. And so there is maybe a hope that this could address that as well. But yeah, you're absolutely right that this is this sort of redistribution of money through development fees is a far cry from the pledge that Merrick Faulkner ran on back in 2013.
I don't know about you guys who think that no one has ever been won over by a developer amenity promise, but I personally was ready to move to Lilac Hills when they said a robot would walk yeah. my child to school. So, counterpoint.
It was quite a vision. Someday maybe we'll see it realized that they were going to go shopping for people too, right? It was going to...
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
I'm there.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast. It's the most popular public affairs podcast recorded expertly in our various homes across San Diego. You have a podcast that's recorded in one of our homes and you want to dispute that claim? Come at us. Keep up with all our big investigations and daily news with the Morning Report. We put that together for you every weekday. Sign up at vosd.org/morning. It's our most popular product. People love it. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Andrew Keats is Assistant Editor. Sarah Libby is Managing Editor. And this show is expertly produced, as you heard earlier, by Nate John. Thank you, Nate. He's doing it from remote this week. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.